Chapter 16. Can internal working models begin in prenatal life? Jonathan was an exceptionally smart, creative, and persistent middle-aged man who had known little happiness. He had been episodically depressed for much of his life and found little joy either in his profession or in his relationships. He described his family of origin as a haven of secrets. His father, he said, was unreachable and explosive when he was present at all, but mostly he just wasn't there. Jonathan admired his dad's independence while acknowledging that his dad's absence meant that responsibility for his mother fell to him, the oldest. His mother, he said, had ways of giving and taking at the same time. He thought that this was one of the reasons he had always been suspicious of the motives of women, feeling certain they would manipulate him to meet needs of their own. Now in his mid-30s, Jonathan was taking care of his mother, having moved her to our community following an illness. He was annoyed that none of his siblings would help with mother's care, but it also seemed to be his job, so he said little about it. Jonathan said he always understood that his role in the family was to keep his parents together. He knew he was born for this purpose. He spoke of a sense that he would have preferred not being born in the first place. That's how much he did not want this responsibility. It was too much to carry alone. Jonathan had 4 younger siblings, including a sister and 3 brothers, but he had always imagined that there was another sib. A twin, perhaps, who was no longer there. He didn't know why he had such a thought. He once asked his mother, but she told him no such thing had ever happened. Jonathan had never had a romantic or sexual relationship with a woman. He had had a number of sexual encounters with men and often had erotic dreams involving men. He didn't really believe he was homosexual, but he couldn't imagine himself as heterosexual either. He just didn't fit anywhere, he said. His religious faith affirmed the badness of his attraction to men. Jonathan told me of a man he once knew who looked so much like him that mutual friends referred to them as twins. He remarked that his friend was weak, just as he had always imagined his twin brother would have been. Had he lived, Jonathan would have needed to look after him. This would have been an acceptable trade-off for the help his twin could have provided in the larger task of keeping the parents together. A twin would also have understood him. He wondered if any of this were connected to his homosexual yearnings, which were often directed at men who looked like himself, but were weaker. They all needed something he could provide. Seconds after Jonathan left our first session, he returned to the office, knocked on the door, and asked if I knew that his middle name was Thomas. He said the name means the twin. His full name, he asserted, was Jonathan the Twin. In the next session, he asked me if I had caught on that he wasn't nearly as interested in actually having sex with men as he was in just lying with them. Mostly, he said, he just wanted to curl up next to a partner. Jonathan reported that he dreamt often, but always forgot the content quickly. He began, at my suggestion, to occasionally tape record his early morning recollections of dreams. One day he brought in a tape and asked if he could simply play it. While he had already forgotten most of the content of the previous night's dream, he had recorded the content when he was barely awake. In the dream, he was walking across a grassy area that reminded him of where he worked. He encountered a canal full of water. It seemed he should jump in, but he did not. A door appeared, and he walked through, whereupon he encountered an attractive, slender woman who appeared to be wounded in some way. He did not recognize her, and they did not speak. She walked away, followed by a man carrying a long, pointy object that looked like a propeller. The man seemed to be blaming Jonathan for the wound from which the woman was suffering. The man then poked at Jonathan with the long, pointy object. In the next scene of the dream, Jonathan found himself in some sort of downward-sloping chute. He noted a kind of Alice in Wonderland quality to the chute. It was narrow, certainly unable to accommodate an adult. There was some sort of traction material on the inside that would keep him from just tumbling down. As Jonathan moved down the chute, he encountered another person, to whom he referred on the tape as a male, who was also going down the chute, and they began to move together. At some point, Jonathan realized that the boy was not going to go all the way down the chute with him. He didn't know why he knew this. He then realized that some sort of graduation was imminent, but the other boy was not going to graduate. He felt very warm about this boy, who resembled someone with whom he had recently had sex. He noticed that the boy's shoes did not match, and he felt embarrassed for him. He noticed how childish the boy was. He had his legs up in the air and was kicking his feet, like a little kid would do. And then, in the dream, Jonathan left the boy behind. Continuing down the chute, Jonathan felt himself to be near the slender woman he had seen earlier, the one who was wounded. He couldn't discern if she was inside the chute with him or somehow outside. He noticed there were cushions along one side of the chute, and there was tomato sauce everywhere. He saw that the woman seemed to be carrying a coffee can-sized object in her hand and that it had tomato sauce in it. He approached the end of the tunnel, where he saw three tiny steps that led to a small door. The woman said, "Is this the right one?" At which point Jonathan awoke. At first, Jonathan said he thought the dream was about a recent job interview, in which the question seemed to be, would he be the one chosen? Musing further, he said it felt to him as if the boy in the chute were his twin. That twin, he thought, left the canal because he wasn't ready to be born, using for the first time a direct reference to birth. He wondered if the man with the long, pointy object was blaming him for the wound to the woman, blaming him for his mother's pregnancy, maybe even blaming him for being born. On top of it all, he wondered if the woman were questioning whether the right twin was born. I don't propose that this dream confirm the truth of Jonathan's twinship. I can only tell you that the enormous ambivalence Jonathan had always experienced about his sexuality was lightened after he had the dream and described it to me. He began to take seriously his earlier notion that he was perhaps not seeking sex at all in his homosexual searches. He was seeking companionship. He was seeking a brother. He wanted to lie with his brother again, as they once had. The dream seemed to evoke some sort of long-delayed grieving. It gave him a way to describe what he was after, and to cut short his self-rebuke about his sexual longings and behavior. It helped him to wonder about his chronic shame and the questions that had been persistent for him for as long as he could remember. Was he the right one? Did he belong here? Did he have any right to happiness? It can't be scientifically established whether or not prenates engage in the construction of internal working models. I don't know precisely when we began trying to find coherence in a narrative, but I found myself respectful of the coherence between Jonathan's dream, his lifetime of longings, and his lifetime of self-doubt. I find myself to this day unable to be dismissive of such stories and such dreams, and the fidelity sometimes noticed between what people once thought about themselves and how they have lived out a model of self. Had I been oblivious before to the possibility of such connections, Juliet certainly would have removed all doubt and made me always sit at full attention to hints of the emergence of very early internal working models. She was 50 and appeared waif-like as she gingerly entered my office for the first time. She was obviously anxious, but I didn't find this as unusual as her physical presence. She appeared small and bent over, not really like an elderly person with back trouble, but more like someone eager to not take up too much space, maybe even to disappear. She moved to the couch with trepidation and began, in the tiniest of voices, to explain why she was here. She was depressed, she said, but then she had always been depressed, so that didn't exactly explain why she had come to see me. She acknowledged that she was adopted and that she had heard in our little community that I knew something about adoption, but she didn't think that was of any consequence, one way or the other. Besides, she was 50. Who still thinks about the fact that they're adopted at 50? She mused. She had never been married, never had a child, and never had happiness. She was in love once, long ago, but she seemed to imply a heaviness and joylessness about even that relationship. She had graduated from college as a young woman, but had always worked at unstimulating, safe jobs. Her dreary, self-dismissive tone never changed. She might as well have been reading from an encyclopedia. I asked if she were proud of anything in her life. Then I asked if she had ever experienced, even momentarily, the joy she seemed to be making clear had never been known to her. Her answer seemed a response to both questions at once. She smiled a little before she spoke, lifting her head ever so slightly. Then she began her description of the box. The box, she said, was an imaginary place to which she went, not in dreams, but in meditative states, rather like daydreams. She said she liked going there. She was proud of what she could accomplish in there. And what was it she accomplishes in there, in this box? Why, she survives, that's what. That has always been the joy of the box, she explained. It's a place she had learned to manage, a place where she had figured out what to do in order to survive. She took mental trips there when she needed a reminder that she had figured things out. This, she seemed to be saying, was her version of joy. It was her narrative. I was lost. Every image aroused in me by her description of this imaginary place lacked anything resembling pleasure, much less joy, much less a feeling of efficacy or accomplishment. But then, this wasn't my representation. It wasn't my narrative. It wasn't my box. It was hers. My job included the setting aside of my own aroused images while I focused intently on trying to follow the story to catch on to the image. It wasn't hard to grasp, she said. The box was a small space in which she was confined. There was no door, no window, no exit. This was a good arrangement, she added, because the danger was on the outside, not the inside. Perhaps no one could get to her inside there. Pathetically, was I having trouble breathing as I listened? I asked about the dangers on the inside. Oh, but that's the point, she asserted. Therapists can be such slow learners, she seemed to be sighing. The only danger inside had to do with the limited supplies of air and food. Those dangers, she explained, were manageable. All she had to do was make herself as small as possible, to curl up in the corner, breathe shallowly, and not make a peep. That way she didn't use up much food or air. The dangers became manageable. The real dangers were on the outside. For some reason, I was having trouble holding back the tears. This was it? This was what brought her joy? This was what she was most proud of, that she had learned to make herself so small that she wouldn't call attention to herself, that she wouldn't use up the air in the box, that she wouldn't need much at all in there. I don't know exactly at what moment we both noticed what we might be talking about, but I remember working hard to sit on my interpretation because I knew the power of it could disappear in a heartbeat if it came too soon or from the wrong lips. In response to one of my early questions about her life, I learned that Juliet had met her birth mom in her 30s. The meeting did not go well, and neither of them ever reached out to the other again. So it was a surprise to me that, following this first session with me, she decided on her own to go see her first mother again. She had a question to ask about that place, that box, in which she had once lay inside that lady. I suppose her birth mom's report, 50 years after it actually happened, didn't surprise either of us. Her birth mom was very young and very alone, and she panicked. She tried to abort by herself. Later, someone helped her to find the path of relinquishment of the baby inside of her, but in one instant, at least, the life of the baby was in mortal danger. Perhaps it had been so for weeks before, as this teen mom's misery and regret were communicated to the infant inside, the infant who came to see me a half century later. Did the unborn child figure out a plan to survive her mother's agony, and later the more concrete effort to kill her? Not in the sense that we usually imagine such figurings, of course, but I certainly gave wonder to what, in fact, an organism does do when it senses imminent and mortal danger. Did she at some point develop a picture of a confined place that had its own kind of safety because in there maybe no one, not even her mother, could get to her, could hurt her? And did she somewhere along the line convert that picture into a kind of narrative? It's not good to make noise, lest someone outside remember that you're in there, in that place where they don't want you to be. It's best to be quiet, small, and have the most minimal of needs so you have the best shot at being able to stay in there and to survive. All I can tell you for certain is that she seemed to have lived for 50 years in utter consonance with such a view of self and of self in the world. This is how she walked, sat, applied for jobs, engaged in relationships, showed up in the world as tiny, not to be bothered with, over here in the corner. In that way, or so the narrative had gone for all these years, she would be safe. She would survive, and that was about as much of an accomplishment as she could hope for. Juliet's insight brought mourning, of course, long delayed, deep in the pits of the soul sorrow, as she faced the realities of her mother's action and of her unhappy life. She came across a book about brave women in my library. To my surprise, she devoured the book and then went on a search for more such stories. She seemed to gain energy from legends of female prowess in the world. She came across material about the Snow Cherokee, the Native Americans who walked the Trail of Tears across the southern part of Illinois, and about a group of women who escaped, hiding in caves in the hills in the dead of winter. She identified with these powerful women who found safety inside of caves, waiting for just the right moment to emerge victorious. Years later, she wrote me from the sunny state where she had moved. She had a good job and was in a romantic relationship. She wanted to check in. More specifically, she wanted to know if her memory was the same as mine about the work we had done. It was. I'm often asked about prenatal life. How much credibility should we give to patients' stories or dreams or ideas that seem to hint at prenatal memory, even prenatal working through? My answer usually is that I don't know. But not for a second would I ever scoff. Never would I doubt the possibility that our minds are active in defense of life and of self before we happen to come out here where everyone can see us.